You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this evening. Once again, as you know, I am the resident historian and history buff, I should say. And a new book came across my desk again a few weeks ago. Lady Editor, The Life of Sarah Josepha Hale. And this is a young woman from New England, a woman who would nowadays would be called the historical Oprah, the historical Ellen DeGeneres, or the historical Martha Stewart. She was doing things back then that many of these modern-day icons do today. So, and joining me as my guest is former Wall Street Journal editor and author of the book, Melanie Kirkpatrick. And we'll be talking with Melanie for the next half hour about the life of Lady Editor and you know, her efforts on behalf of women years ago, when most of us would believe that women had no rights, had no say in anything. Well, this particular young lady certainly did, and she made a big impact on many people whose lives she touched. Melanie, nice to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Al.
First and foremost, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, in the annals of history, you know, back in her time, and we're talking, 19th century, she was a rarity, right?
I think she was the most influential woman of the 19th century and one of the most influential women of our history. And she's not really well known today. She was a celebrity back then. Everybody knew who Mrs. Hale was. And, you know, you'd see her quoted in newspapers, and they would just say, Mrs. Hale says, rarely giving the full name because she was so well known.
Now, did I get the, again, as we get started, I want to, because I'm notorious for messing up names, but it's Sarah, was it Josepha or Josepha Hale?
Perfect, Josepha.
Josepha,
and,
okay.
I checked with people in her hometown of Newport, New Hampshire, and they tell me it's Josepha.
Okay. Now, she grew up in the rural, just said the rural mountains of New Hampshire. At that time, women were thought to be sticking on the property, taking care of children, doing the laundry, the cooking, and just serving the needs of the males. Did she, from an early start, have a different attitude toward? I know she was married. I know she had children. She lost her husband in the midst of caring for those young children. But did she always carry in the back of her mind the notion that, you know, I'm going to make more of my life. I'm not just going to be somebody who's subservient to my husband.
You have a couple of questions there, Al, so let me try to unpack it, the answer. She was born in 1788. That's the year before George Washington took office as president. And she grew up, as you said, on a little farm in New Hampshire. But her parents, like a lot of New Englanders, were very keen on education. So she and her brothers, she had two older brothers and a younger sister, were homeschooled, particularly one brother. The two of them learned together. Her mother taught them. And when it came time, they were very intellectual. She read voraciously. And when it came time for her brother to go off to prep school and then to Dartmouth, she couldn't go because girls were not, there was no college that accepted girls at that point in our history. But her brother would come home from Dartmouth, and he'd teach her everything he had learned. So, and she studied stuff that, like botany and Latin and stuff that girls didn't usually study. And by the end of, by the time her brother Horatio graduated, she had had the equivalent of a Dartmouth education. I like to think that she was the first young woman to graduate from Dartmouth 150 years before the first woman actually got a degree from Dartmouth in the 1970s. And so I don't think that she ever had ambitions, Al, because there were no models. There was no such thing as a professional author. Back then, a person who wanted to publish a book usually had to fund it himself. And she certainly knew of no women who wrote books. She recounts that as a young person, she came across the Mysteries of Udolpho, a 18th century Gothic novel written by a woman in England. And she fell in love with it, and in part because it was written by a woman. She said it was the first book she had ever read by a woman. But when her husband died in 1822, leaving her with four children and a fifth on the way, she was determined that she was going to find a way to educate her children, her boys, and her girls in the way that she and her husband had decided. But she didn't have any money, and so what she did was, with the help of Freemasons — her husband had been a prominent Freemason in Newport, New Hampshire — she published a book of her poetry, which was privately published, as I said, and that really inspired her to keep writing. She had been writing, a lot. She and her husband used to spend every evening together studying at the sitting room table, and her husband helped her develop her prose style. So after the book of poetry came out, she then wrote a novel. And it came out, it was called Northwood. It was an anti-slavery novel, and it came out in 1827. This called her to the attention of a man in Boston, whom she didn't know. He was an Episcopal priest, and he ran a girls' school, and he wanted to start a magazine for women. This is all we know about him or his intentions. Mm-hmm. And he asked her if she would move to Boston and edit it. And she said yes. She was roundly criticized for this by her friends in town, but she thought that this was the only way she would be able to make enough money and move in the circles, I think, where she would be able to educate her kids. She had to send four of her kids off to live with relatives while she and the baby went to Boston. And that's how she got started. To give you a sense of what a leap of faith this was, consider that there had been no women's magazine that had been successful at that point. And there had been no women's magazine that was anything other than really frivolous. And she was determined to have her magazine be a serious intellectual journal, and she wanted to follow two topics very closely. One was educating women, and I hope we can talk about that. And second was helping to create an American literary culture.
And I think that was the, as you said, that was the pinnacle up until that point. As you said, women were thought of, whatever you wrote up to that point, nobody took serious, nobody took note of it. Two things that stuck out in my mind. One, she was certainly driven, more so than I think a lot of people can imagine. Today people think, we've empowered women, but it's only been recently. No, she was way ahead of her time. But going back to what you said, and I think it's the focal point of the whole book, is that she didn't want just something that was all gloss but really no substance. She wanted a publication that would leave a lasting imprint on women and future generations. And I think in the back of her mind, and correct me if I'm wrong, Melanie, that she was hoping that this would transcend itself and boost women's in the eyes of their families, in the eyes of town folk or anybody, that, you know what, we can do just as much as a man can do. We can do many things, but you're going to have to give us the opportunity. And it was inspirational as well as educational, was it not?
I think that's right. At the same time, I think maybe the way you phrased it, you're putting a more modern gloss on it. She had complicated views about the role of women, and she did not subscribe to the idea of completely separate spheres for men and women. But she did think that women and men were different, and she had ideas about the natural role for where women could participate in society. For example, she thought women made better teachers than men. And here it gets really interesting, because in 1828, when she began her magazine, women were considered intellectually inferior to men and not mentally or even physically equipped to control a classroom. They thought that women's physical inferiority compared to men was a detriment in controlling boys in the classroom, for example. But one of Hale's many, many campaigns was to have women become teachers. And I'll have to say that by the 1840s and the 1850s, you can see that this changed. And women by the 1850s were a majority of teachers. So that was one area where she was influential, I believe, in changing the mindset of her readers about the roles of women. She also, of course, believed that, and this was, I shouldn't say of course, this was a radical idea. She believed that women could do anything that men could do that didn't require physical strength. She believed that they could do anything that men could do, provided they had the education to do so. So this is why she focused so heavily on education. And, you know, at that period of time, there were, in 1828, only half of American women were literate. There were more men who were literate at the period, And there was no college, as I mentioned earlier, that would accept women. And not many what we would call high schools or institutions of higher learning. There were female seminaries where women would learn things like embroidery and painting and maybe French, but just one or two serious intellectual places of higher education for young women. And one thing Hale did in her magazines, and this went on for many years, she would find out about these girls' schools all around the country, a small country, of course, at that period of time, and write about them, talking about their curriculum, how much it costs to go to them, the history of the woman who ran the school. And the idea was to become a kind of bulletin board for learning about where a girl could get education. So if parents decided they wanted their girls to get a good education, they would turn to Hale's magazines to find out what the selection was.
I want to take a quick pause, and I want to come back and pick up where we just left off. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. This is The Public Eye. I'm Al Vona, your host. My guest this week is author Melanie Kirkpatrick. We're talking about her new book, The Life of Sarah Josepha Hale, Lady Editor, long before it was even acceptable. She led the way of educating. And I think that's the main theme here of educating women long before it was thought proper to do so, in hopes that that they could function on their own, they could devote and contribute. And it certainly was the Melanie, I think you'd agree, I think she really was a trailblazer. But one thing I do want to know, I just want to take a step back, and I didn't know this until reading your book. We've all heard it when we were kids, Mary Had a Little Lamb, the little nursery rhyme. I didn't know all these years, I mean, I'm sure my mother, at least my mother, I don't know about my father, probably many nights sat down and read this to us. But it was Sarah Josepha Hale that wrote that, right?
Yeah, not Mother Goose, Al. It was Sarah Josepha Hale.
Wow.
It's interesting. She wrote it in 1830. It was published in a book of poems for children. And it was immediately picked up and put to music and appeared in one of the first school songbooks. She wasn't credited in the songbook. And then McGuffey's readers. Have you heard about those?
Yeah.
McGuffey's readers, which were readers that were popular from the first half of the 19th century, and they were in use in American schools up until the 1940s.
Right.
And they were they decided to use to structure a reading lesson around Mary Had a Little Lamb. So now you had generations of school children learning the poem. But again, there was no credit given to her.
Yeah.
So, which was not uncommon for the day. Copyright didn't exist or wasn't used during that period. So, and toward the end of her life, she had to defend her authorship of the poem. And then as the years went by, her son and one of her nephews also had to do the same into the 20th century, pardon me. But one thing I want to say about Mary Had a Little Lamb, which I think is interesting because it tells you something about Hale. We all know the first stanza where the little lamb goes to school, follows Mary to school, and everybody laughs at to see a lamb at school. But the poem originally had three verses, and the third verse carried a moral, and the moral was be kind to animals. Treat them well. And this was, she did a lot of writing for children and helped to switch kind of children's writing from what it had been in the past, kind of didactic lecturing sorts of books, into more enjoyable stories with real kids in them. Her poetry for children and her stories for children always carried a moral. She thought that this went along with her idea of how to teach kids. You had to make it entertaining in order to hold their education and to help the lessons stick in.
Yeah, make it fun. I mean, that's really, you know, I think to this day, that's still the crux of it, at least the foundation. If you make something fun, you're going to get young people to engage. So she was, again, you know, where...
Yeah, the other tenet of her teaching ideas was that kids had to learn at their own pace.
Mm-hmm.
And back in Newport, New Hampshire, before she got married, she opened a little school for a few years. And it was successful, but she discouraged the prominent teaching technique of the day, which was called blabbing. And this was when a teacher would stand up in front of the school and recite and then have the kids repeat it. So the teacher would, you know, for a spelling lesson, the teacher would say, here's how you spell it. Or for an arithmetic lesson, she'd say the sum out loud, and then the kids were supposed to repeat it. Now Hale disapproved of this method of teaching and said that instead of blabbing, kids had to learn at their own pace.
Mm.
So her kids in her school would each individually take up whatever they were learning and proceed at a more individual pace.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. We don't have a lot of time, but I did want to get this question into you. I know you talked about her mom and dad. They were pro education. They were people that, you know, thought, you know, you shouldn't be illiterate. You should be, you know, somewhat self-educated. And she did sit down. You talked about sitting down with her husband at night and did a lot of, you know, back and forth writing and probably conversing and helping one another. But he died, you know, as you said, young, left her a widow with five young children. So was her father any male in her circle, for lack of another term, who was supportive, especially at that time, of her efforts?
That's the key question, Al. Back then, of course, a woman had no, a married woman had no financial rights, no economic rights, no property rights of her own. And when her husband died, she was really left alone. She had her father had died a few years previously. Her older brother had disappeared at sea. He was a seaman. And the brother, Horatio, with whom she was closest, was a lawyer, but he had moved far away to Glens Falls, New York, and he didn't have a lot of money. She got help from the Freemasons in town, but for the most part, she was left on her own. And when she began to earn a living as a writer, I can safely say she was one of the first, if not the first, American woman to earn a living that way.
I think that is absolutely incredible. No, lost her husband. Not a lot of family support. You know, deaths are, you know, as you said, the older brother Horatio moving away. All by 5 young kids. I mean, even today that would seem an overwhelming burden. But at a time when there weren't that many social supports, if you will.
Right.
She really, I mean, I guess you could call her a true, you know, bootstrapper. But yeah. In the final, you know, in the final moments that we have, I've got to ask you, I used at the outset, I talked about Oprah, Ellen DeGeneres, Martha Stewart. Was that a fair comparison? You know, I know that was, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put her together with you know, maybe, but she was more intellectual than any of them. She was certainly, in terms of the celebrity status, yes, she was like them. But you have to throw in a little bit of Nikki Haley and Ruth Bader Ginsburg,
right,
and others in order to get a better sense of her. She also she was deeply, deeply patriotic. And if we have just a moment, I'd like to speak briefly about the role she is best known for, which is, and I think is her most lasting legacy, which is Thanksgiving. She used the pages of her magazine, Godey's Ladies book, to encourage the development of a national Thanksgiving holiday. At that period in time, states, the governors of states would order a Thanksgiving Day, and so every state celebrated on a different day. There wasn't coordination. She thought that if we had a national Thanksgiving Day, that is, every American celebrating the holiday on the same day, it would draw the country together. And as we got closer to civil war, she hoped it would prevent war. So she also, at the same time as she campaigned for this in the pages of Godey's Ladies book, she also conducted a private writing campaign to what we would call influencers today. She wrote to every governor. She wrote to a series of presidents of the United States, starting with Zachary Taylor. And everybody turned her down. The president said that, oh no, they didn't have the constitutional power to call a national Thanksgiving. But finally in 1863, Lincoln, in the middle of the Civil War, Lincoln took up her suggestion and called the first in what has become an unbroken series of national Thanksgivings.
What a great, I mean, I didn't mean to cut you off. We're just running out of time. But I mean, so many things that this one woman did at an era and at a time when you know, it just was unheard of for women to do that. Real quickly, Melanie, if people, the book obviously is now out in publication, Lady Editor, Life of Sarah Josepha Hale. But if people want to pose just questions to you directly or just get more information about your work, is there a way of doing that?
Yeah, the book has a Facebook page, and I encourage readers to, it's a public Facebook page, and I would encourage readers to take a look at that.
Yeah, and I can tell you that whether you're a big history buff or not, this book, and I think you've heard a little bit about it this evening in my conversation with Melanie, Mary Had a Little Lamb, something that people just take for granted today. It's just, you know, where did that come from? But it's been so famous. The one who forged bringing Thanksgiving together as a national holiday. So many things that this one woman did at a time when, as I said at the outset, so many women did not have that opportunity, nor were they even probably given the time of day to put forward. But she was really a fighter. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can go to our safe and secure website 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and view all the programming that we do, including the public eye here on WICN. Again, I want to thank my guest this week, former Wall Street Journal editor and author Melanie Kirkpatrick. The book, The Life of Sarah Josepha Hale, Lady Editor. For the public eye, this is Al Bunker.